This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Folk Runyon. And tonight we have as a very special guest, occultist and author Anne Finnan, who will discuss her latest book, a romance novel with an occult theme called The Dear Departed. And in this case, the title tells us the story. A Victorian age romance novel dealing with spiritualism. Anne informs us that the story is told in Dion Fortune style and that the hero is a roguish hermetic magician aiding the prim Victorian heroine against a Svengali-like spiritualist cult leader. Anne is also the author of The Sorcerer of St. Felice, a novel of magic and alchemy set in medieval France. Anne is the high priestess of the Roebuck, which is a Celtic Wiccan tradition. She is a certified hypnotist, an accomplished astrologer, and a talented harpist. She can be seen officiating as priestess in our Rites of Magic video, and as the Enochian-speaking Christian charismatic in Beyond Lemuria. So, join us tonight for an hour with Anne Finnan and the Dear Departed. Hello there, Anne.
Hey, Polk. Can you hear me okay?
Oh, yeah, I can hear you fine. And, a few questions about the Dear Departed before we get going here. Did you do this multiple viewpoint it's going to appeal to female readers if it is a romance, which it is. Perhaps not a bodice ripper, but a romance novel. It's in that
style.
There's
a couple of bodices that get ripped during the course of things.
Oh, good. I meant that. All bodices should be ripped sooner or later.
But to answer your question, it's in both points of view, switching back and forth. That's kind of a romance novel trope that people used to write. Now it's different. There are romances that are written in the first person with the heroine's point of view, but most romance novels are written from both points of view because you want to get both the hero and heroine revealing their thoughts and their impressions. There's also scenes in the book where the heroine is not present, and particularly some of the magical scenes that the hero is doing on his own, and it makes more sense to be in his point of view. So it kind of switches back and forth as most romance novels do.
Well, I can say most adventure novels these days do too, and I've written them both ways myself. But anyway, so tell us, I think our listeners are probably fairly knowledgeable about the spiritualist movement, as you and I both know, and most of our listeners also know, there was a great deal of fraud involved in it, and possibly, as you're indicating, dangerous. Not just monetary fraud, but dangerous. Psychological dangers and what we would call magical dangers too. So anyway, tell us. Go ahead and tell us about how you came about the idea for this, and then spin the tale for us.
Well, the idea for it came from a very dear friend of mine in England, who is both a stage magician and a member of a magical order. And we were talking at one point about how in many ancient tribes, even today in some African tribes, where the medicine man or the shaman would perform sleight of hand tricks and make things appear and disappear to play to the gallery and bolster the faith of the people of the tribe, with the idea that if the people in the tribe believed in his powers, he would have a better chance of performing his healing rituals and his soul retrievals and all of the things that shamans did. So the stage magic tradition very much draws on that, where the production of illusions by sleight of hand and by misdirection and by flim-flam of various sorts is used, of course, now for entertainment. But shamans of all kinds, even now, they use them to convince their sitters or their clients that they have special powers. So it was the combination of the sleight of hand that, of course, Harry Houdini was the classic one, and his book, A Magician Among the Spirits, was very influential in revealing a lot of the spiritualist tricks that that they would use to convince their sitters that they were actually contacting the spirits of their dead departed. And in the book, the spiritualist medium uses a lot of these tricks to convince a bunch of wealthy widows that he can put them in touch with their dearly departed husbands. And as soon as they make out their wills in his favor, he conjures up a thought form to visit them in the form of their dearly departed husband, and he proceeds to murder them. And this goes on, and nobody is the wiser until the local Golden Dawn Lodge, which the hero is a member of, gets wind of this and decides to send the hero to investigate. And since he is a stage magician, he knows all of the tricks. And the lodge sends him to investigate to see if this is just flim flam, or if this fellow is using real magic to do away with these widows. And so his task is to infiltrate this spiritualist circle to discover just what the villain is doing to murder these widows so conveniently. And the heroine is there, who's a very much a skeptic and very much a realist, but her aunt is very taken with all of this and is very much a true believer, and she's afraid that Aunt Marion is going to be, the next victim on the roster. So she has to try to protect her aunt, but then she finds that not only are the spiritualist tricks phony, but there is some serious real magic behind all of it that really does murder these wealthy widows. So she has to basically come to terms with thought forms and hypnosis and all of the psychological magical stuff that was very much a part of what the Golden Dawn did back then. So she has.
Well, of course, the Golden Dawn was very much against hypnosis, and so they even made their members take an oath not to allow themselves ever to be put under hypnosis. Anyway, I just thought I'd throw that
in.
Yeah,
and one of the things that the villain does that goes counter to the to the lodge is that he does use hypnosis in convincing these widows that they have really been in touch with their dear departed husbands, who are waiting, hat in hand, with a bouquet of flowers and a box of candy. Wait, just right across the veil, and all they have to do to, get in his loving arms and get carried off to eternal bliss, is to die. And he convinces these widows that they really are in touch with their husbands, and he does it with hypnotic suggestion. Very, very.
That's why they die in their sleep, right?
They die in their sleep, but the thought form it functions as kind of a medieval incubus. It goes in and it sort of drains them of their life force and kind of throttles them and hastens the process along a little bit. But they welcome it into their boudoirs because it has the form of their dearly departed husband. So it's really a very sinister plot that would absolutely go undetected if it weren't for the fact that the lodge sends this fellow who is not only a stage magician, but he is a real magician, to not only find out what this guy is doing, but stop it. And they have to do a banishment ritual and all this other stuff.
Well, this is a fascinating idea. Let me say this, I think you the same way as I've had numerous offers from people to get me into the spiritualist end of things, and I've always refused. And I have, because I know that there's such a tremendous yearning that the widow or the widower has for his departed mate, this yearning almost creates the thought form you're talking about.
It certainly is something that the thought form feeds off of. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of emotional energy that is generated by all of this. And, of course, in the book I use, of course, the thought form is being a kind of incubus, is feeding off of the sexual energy. But back in my younger days, I was involved with a spiritualist church, kind of on the periphery. I had a roommate at the time who was studying with a local spiritualist church, and she was studying to be a medium, and my astrology teacher at the time was the friend of one of the mediums in this church, and I used to attend these things, and I would play the piano when my astrology teacher would sing hymns for this church. And so, of course, I was present when they conjured up the spirits of everybody's dear departed, and it wasn't just husbands and wives. The really tragic part of it was people who had lost children, and rather than move on and take care of their other children, they would come to this service every week and get a message from their little angel that had passed over, and keep shoveling money into the coffers of this outfit. And it was hard to tell, at least for me, whether the mediums that were doing all of this really believed in what they were doing, or whether this was just a really cold-blooded con. But they would, from the spirits of those who had departed. And this was not 1800. This was 1971.
Oh, I know. It was very popular back in Victorian times, but it's still hanging on.
Oh, yeah.
And you probably read The Psychic Mafia by
Lamarck. Oh, that was an amazing book. I still don't know whatever happened to the fellow. I don't think there was a follow-up, but he ended up joining a Masonic lodge, if I recall, that kind of set him straight on what he was doing and persuaded him that he was wrong to lead these people on to believe that their loved ones were still, you know, hanging around when very often they're not.
Unfortunately, we still have a lot of occultists, and I know some of them, and if they're listening, please forgive me for saying this, but every time one of these guys or gals talks about ectoplasm, the expression on my face tells them what I think about it.
Yeah, it was pretty awful that some of the stuff, that the ectoplasm would ooze out of various orifices of the body, and some of the descriptions of it were quite yucky.
when Harry Houdini turned the lights on Marjorie the medium, that oh boy, that was quite a thing. In the latest TV docudrama on that, they managed to keep that from being X-rated, but that,
pretty awful. The sad part about Houdini, and I read, of course, Magician Among the Spirits, and the tragic part of that was Houdini desperately wanted to believe that his beloved mother was still around and trying to communicate with him, and it took he even went to the wife of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who was a medium, he desperately wanted proof that his mother had, you know, survived beyond the grave, and that she was out there somewhere and still loved him and all this, and he never found, even from this woman, even from Lady Doyle, he could not find enough proof or evidence that satisfied him this was real, and that you know, he knew too much about the con. And he tried to believe. He desperately wanted to, but he just did not find the evidence that satisfied him that this was real. And it was just a very sad thing.
You know that Harry and his wife, both of them, back when they were getting started, they used to do gaff seances, but they did them primarily for entertainment. And they presented them as more or less as a stage act, as entertainment. But because he had mastered all the tricks of doing it, he was acutely aware when he realized that these people were taking them, were victimizing people who had lost their loved ones, and Harry realized that, and that's when he went on a campaign. And of course, you're right, he really did want to contact his mother. None of them could, and he was mad at them because they were all, you know, he thought, oh, they're all fake, you know. And so they went on this campaign, to expose them, we did the Houdini seance at the Magic Castle, and I told the narrator down there that the seance, of course, we had an earthquake right in the middle. When they were shaking the table, we had an earthquake, so it's a really effective special effect to have an earthquake for table turning. But I told them the joke about the Houdini seance, and they'd never heard it at the Magic Castle. So I think they know it now. But anyway, the story is that Harry, his favorite snack was bagels and lox, and so for the seance, they should put out Harry's favorite snack if they want to try to conjure Harry. And naturally, he's a disembodied spirit. He's not going to eat the bagels, but they thought he might pick at the lox.
Ooh, that is awful.
I never get that one in. Anyway, let's get back to the story, though, Pidgeon. I'm fascinated by this this character you've created here, this the rogue. And you used a term that I'm not too familiar with. Demimonde.
It's basically these were the people who were considered not respectable in Victorian society. They were the artists. They were the writers. They were the people.
The Bohemians.
Yeah. They never really got married. They never had families. They had uncertain sources of income. They were part of odd religious groups and odd artistic groups, and they slept around a lot and all that. Dionne Fortune describes them very, very well in a lot of her books, where they were, you know, they wore shabby clothes and they just were not considered to be proper people. They were also some of them into things like smoking opium and other hallucinogens, and many of them were in ill health. So they took a variety of drugs in order to combat the ravages of, say, consumption or
trying to act like left bank fin de sec of Gaelic counterparts over in Paris.
Well, yeah, and that's basically what they were. And San Francisco at this time, this is just right before the earthquake. This was a very, very cosmopolitan city. And there were people from all over the world that would come because it was a trading center. And they the ships would come in and they'd have goods from all over the world, and they'd have sailors from all over the world. And they'd congregate on the Barbary Coast, which actually was a real place. It's down by the Embarcadero now, but back then it's a, you know, den of thieves and sordid saloons and all that. And the sailors would get off the ships and offload their cargo, and then they'd go get drunk in the saloons, and they'd find the girls, and they'd go to the opium dens, and which were run by the Chinese, and there was a very, very strong Chinese presence in San Francisco, and so you had a lot of.
Is your story set in San Francisco?
Yes, it is San Francisco in the 1890s, which was something that was interesting because a lot of these gaslight Victorian romances are set in in London, but the San Francisco was still had that kind of Wild West lawlessness that that was so prevalent in California at that particular time, but it was a very wealthy city, and there were some very, very rich people that lived up on Nob Hill, and they were shipping people and railroad people, and they built these mansions on the hill, and they basically lived like proper Victorian society, and they had soirees, and they'd had their cotillions, and they'd had all the things that proper upper class people had.
Sure they had a golden dawn, though, but they could have.
Well, they could have, and keep in mind that this is probably about this same time that the Rosicrucian Lodge in San Jose was built. That was turn of the century, and that was built by people who were maybe not golden dawn per se, but they were Rosicrucians. And in the book, I never call it a Rosicrucian Lodge. I never call it a Golden Dawn Lodge. It's a Rosicrucian Lodge. It's the Isis Nephthys Temple of the Order of the Rosy Cross. Is what it's called. And it's it was basically a forerunner of the same crowd that built the Rosicrucian Temple down in San Jose. So
yeah.
They were very much a presence in California at the time. So, because I've been to that temple in San Jose, and oh man, I mean that's pretty impressive stuff. But that was the era that it was built in, was the early 20th century. So now the lodge that I have in the book is not quite that magnificent. They meet in an old tavern down on the Embarcadero, and everybody has Chinese houseboys and things. But these Chinese houseboys know a lot more than they're saying too. You know, it's a lot
yeah.
of these, you know, like you did in your movie about the Tibetan mule skinner. You know, there were a lot of Chinese that came to California during that time to work on the railroads, and that were very well versed in various esoteric disciplines and all that. So, you know, they knew their stuff back then too. So it was a real cauldron full of all sorts of people from all over the world with all sorts of odd traditions. And
well, I agree with you. That San Francisco is a great setting for something like this. This is yeah. You're right, because they were really trying to be as continental as they possibly could be, and as fashionable as they could be, and in all the areas, and especially with the Bohemian element. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I think you got a great. I'm looking forward to it. I haven't dipped into it yet, but I'm looking forward to it, especially with the San Francisco. Because I've been up to San Francisco numerous times. Lauren and I both have, and we love that city.
Oh,
especially
if you look at the history before the earthquake. If you want something that's chilling, in my research, I found that it's on YouTube, there was a film that was made in 1906 going down Market Street on one of the cable cars. And this enterprising fellow was using one of those old crank movie cameras, and which was, you know, the state of the art back then, and he was making this film on a cable car going down Market Street. And for a tourist agency, that they wanted to attract tourism to San Francisco, and so he had this film that he made, and it's fascinating because you see this, you know, you're going down Market Street, and there's all the people running all across the street, and all of the not just carriages, but there were cars, those old Model T Fords, you know, those old cars that. Chitty chitty bang bang type cars, you know, that were up and down the street, and the horses were all getting spooked by them, and all this, and they had no idea when this thing was actually filmed. They knew it was 1906, I think, but they didn't know when. It turned out that it was filmed a week before the earthquake, or less than that, like 4 days before the earthquake. So you got to see what San Francisco looked like just, you know, hours before the earthquake. And then there is another film that's the chilling part, where somebody takes that same trip down Market Street with a movie camera and records all the devastation, all the buildings that were burned, all the buildings that were knocked down. It's really, really chilling. If you want to see what, you know, what the before and after, it's fascinating of that what happened during the earthquake.
Do you use the earthquake as a sort of a climax in your book?
No, I too much else going on, and I thought, well, you know, maybe not this book, but no, that's why I made it earlier. The year is 1897, which is just,
yeah.
You know, right before that the heyday of the, because I wanted the ambiance of the carriages and the horses and the old Victorian mansions that had the gas lights and you know, the creaky windows and all that. And so I wanted to make it just a little earlier. When one of the things about these romance novels, there is a very curious taboo, it used to be anyway, of setting your romance novel any later than about 1900. You never saw romances set any later than that. And I think what happens with like motor cars and airplanes and like in the 20s or something, it was a little too modern. Got something that's prior to 1900. It seems like it's less history and more myth. There's a mythic quality to it.
Yeah.
So a lot of like, you know, classic vampire novels and all that are tend to be set before 1900 because of that old timey mythic quality. That when these things get to be too modern, then it loses something, which is interesting because if you remember, if you've ever read, I'm sure you have, the original Bram Stoker Dracula.
Yeah.
That was set in his contemporary time. You know, this was a contemporary novel as far as he was concerned.
Yeah.
But it got, you know, as the whole vampire mythos developed, vampire novels were nearly always Victorian until just very recently. And I think it loses something when it's a little too modern. You know,
they had some anachronisms in Dracula, you know, so. One of the boys was from Texas, and he had a Bowie knife and a single action 45, you know, and that jars you a little bit, you know.
Well, it jars you only because you've got 100-year perspective, you know. But what would Bram Stoker know about what an actual Texan in 1890 would have?
Yeah.
They couldn't look it up on Wikipedia back then, you know. They had to pretty much go with whatever they gleaned from popular novels as a writer, you'll appreciate this. I actually tried to write that book originally as a contemporary using, instead of a spiritualist medium, using one of these New Age channeler types, you know.
Yeah.
like we used to joke about years ago, you know, and you know, Ma Fu and Ramtha and whatever, but it didn't work because you didn't have the suspension of disbelief. You didn't have People were too sophisticated for a lot of that stuff, and so I decided to set the novel in Victorian times because people believed in stuff easier back then, and there were things that I needed to have happen that you couldn't have gotten away with in the 70s. It just didn't work, or the 90s when I first started this thing. So there's reasons why these stories are set in less technologically sophisticated. People just were a little bit less rational, a little bit less techie. You know, there was a poetic quality to it.
Yeah.
And
there is a kind of a formula, though, that like, for instance, immediately when I started reviewing this, I got to thinking about Gothic. It's this, we've had a real spat of Gothic romance novels, the vampire thing, it got into that, or it got into the vampire thing, and I don't think the werewolves were too successful because, you know, they're a little bit too hairy for the romance crowd, but au contraire.
There's a whole subset, werewolf romances. I mean, the werewolf romances are extremely popular, and there's several authors that have long-standing series of human females that fall in love with the head of the wolf pack, and I have a very dear friend that reviewed my book that I was in one of my critique groups for years and years, and she writes werewolf stories where her heroes are members of a werewolf pack, and these things tend to be like, you know, families.
Well, I read Anne Rice. I read Anne Rice's two werewolf books,
yeah.
and I kind of liked them.
They're interesting.
I didn't like the werewolves descending from a bunch of apes on an island off Africa, though. I didn't care for that. Werewolves ought to come from Central Europe or Mongolia or somewhere like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the most popular background for werewolf packs that turn into romance heroes are out in the Boontuli somewhere, where there's families that have these tendencies, and they're not necessarily descended from actual beasts. They're more like it's almost a shamanic thing. I mean, these are
yeah.
the way they're set up. They don't quite say that, but they're set up in a way where it makes you think that these are people who have a family ability to do this, and so it's very much like the old witch families, you know, where you had families that had strange powers that were passed down generations and you've seen
my Baron Black Wolf
it's that same kind of thing where you have families that have these odd powers and certain people in each generation have them and certain people don't, and the power gets passed down through the generations to certain people, and I did a little bit of that in the book where the hero doesn't know who his father was.
Jonathan Bradshaw, your hero.
He doesn't know who his father was. His mother was a very famous actress, and of course back then actresses had many lovers that they had at the same time, and so he was raised not knowing who his actual father was, and he's taken on as a protege by a stage magician that turns out to be his actual natural father, and he doesn't know this until the villain reveals it to him, part of his internal conflict is that he doesn't know if he actually has the power to defeat this thing, or if he's just a carny man, you know, if he's just a
this is a very good idea, but you know, and I'm reminded of I am your father, Luke.
Yeah, well, I know, and unfortunately, I wrote this, you know, with that in my head, you know, like, I am your father, Luke. But if you look at it in that way, Darth Vader had to be Luke's father. Luke had to have inherited the Force or whatever that ability was, this sort of shamanic ability. From some place that these things are families. It was explained to me years ago that it was there were castes and families of people who were the shamans and who were the artists and in these ancient tribes, and they like the Druids. You know,
we all know that Lucas cut his teeth on Joseph Campbell.
Oh, sure.
And then there are a few of us who know that Joseph Campbell cut his teeth on Lord Raglan. So it comes down from Hercules and Beowulf and
sure,
all the rest
sure.
of
this
them.
This is a very very
yeah,
ancient
sure.
tradition of the people that are of
yeah.
the blood, people who have the basically have the mark of Cain. They are the people that were half human and half angel, and they have these strange powers. This goes all the way back to the Book of Enoch. So you have a family that has a genetic predisposition to, you know, what they used to call the sight. In the Scottish Highlands, and this went down through the generations, and this is where the I got my Book of Shadows from my grandmother. You know, that's where that comes from, because it very often skipped a generation, and you got your power and you got your knowledge from your grandparents. And this is all the way down to Harry Potter. This is the whole mudblood thing from Harry Potter, where you have the half breeds, you have the people who are only half witch or only half magician.
By the way, next week we're gonna be doing fairy magic, which we haven't done before. And so you might want to call in on that one, because you're very very qualified to talk about that too, and we'll be talking about that and you know, dealing with this grimoire, this Elizabethan grimoire that Llewellyn just came out with, called the Book of Oberon, and also Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norvell, or Mr. Strange and Jonathan Norvell, or which way, I get them mixed up. Strange and Norrell, and the whole business of fairy magic. So,
well, it comes down to the same sort of thing. If you have, there's an old tradition, not just in Celtic countries, but in Germanic countries, where you've got the changelings, you know, these children that are either taken by the fairies, or they have fairy parents, where you have people that will marry a fairy, and children will have odd powers, and that these powers are passed down. There's a wonderful film on that that was put out some years ago called The Secret of Rowan Inish, if you've ever seen it. It's basically about the Selkies in this Highland island, where all of the people on that island are descended from one of the seal people, who basically were fairies. Shape-changing fairies.
Yeah.
And what this enterprising young fellow did is that he went out to one of the islands where the seal people would shed once I guess under the full moon or something, what they would do is they would shed their seal skins, and they would be human, and they would dance under the full moon. And if you stole the seal skin, then you had control over the fairy, or in this case, a woman. Not they weren't all women, but in this case, a woman, who became this fellow's wife, and she bore him a dozen children until one of her children found the seal skin hidden in the attic, and she put on her seal skin and off she went. But the entire island, the whole entire population of the island was descended from this Selkie, this seal woman.
Now, what's the title of this film?
The Secret of Rowan Inish. Rowan Inish. It's you can ask Dave. We've got it on.
All right. I want to look at it.
And it's set in modern times. Post World War II, where they had to evacuate this island because of the war, and the people that were evacuated had to find their way back to the island because the seal people were still there, and they were relatives. They were descended from these people. The Inuit, some of the Eskimo tribes have that same legend where they are descended from people that turn into seals or dolphins or something. So there's a long tradition of that, not just in...
The Mongolians think they descend from a wolf that mates with a deer, if you can imagine that one. But anyway, let's get back to the Dear Departed for a minute. Number one, where do you get it?
Amazon.
It doesn't seem to be on Amazon.
Yes, Amazon is your friend. It comes both in the Kindle version and in a print version. You can actually buy a physical book. I'm writing under the name of Anne Roebuck, which is a little inside joke for those of you.
That's why I couldn't find it.
And the reason I did that is, on the one hand, I wanted to, all of this is about building your brand, and I wanted to establish myself as a romance author under a different name than my monastery books, which I'm going to try, since I have the rights back from that, I'm going to try to maybe publish it myself at some point. You can either search for The Dear Departed or Anne Roebuck. That's Anne with an E. I also have a website, anneroebuck.com, and you can order it from there. Lots of different places to get it. And I was delighted to find out that it wasn't just an e-book, that they actually... it's a print-on-demand thing, and they actually have printed books, and it's got a cover.
Is it a trade-quality paperback?
Yeah, trade-quality paperback. Well, one of the things that's happening in publishing now, just as a quick aside, for anyone who's interested, the traditional publishers are actually going to some of these, automatic print houses. So there is virtually no difference between a paperback from one of these small print-on-demand publishers and, Putnam or, whatever they're called now. I think there were five of them. Now I think that there are four. They're all being kind of consolidated and all that. The nice thing about that is that a lot of the, as they consolidated all these publishing companies, a lot of the editors and, layout artists and cover artists and copy editors and things like that would go freelance. So you've got some absolutely professional quality people who are freelancing for a lot of these small presses.
Mm-hmm.
So my my editor at Burroughs Publishing, the editor in chief there used to be an editor at Kensington. He was my friend who writes the werewolf books. He was her editor. So you've got a lot of people who have been laid off, who have bailed from traditional publishers, that are setting themselves up at these small presses. And I had to go through the whole thing with the rewrites and developmental edits and copy edits and line edits and all of that stuff. I had, you know, galleys I had to check through and all of that stuff. So, you know, they ran a professional outfit. So I was very impressed because, you know, you just think of, oh, well, small press, ebook, vanity press, you know, they'll publish anything if you pay them money enough. But no, this was an absolute professional outfit. And I have to say that, you know, after the editing process, my editor was a little gal who apparently had been a script editor in Hollywood. So she knew storyboarding and pacing and all this other stuff. And
Is this a subsidy press
regular press. The only difference between a small press like this and Putnam or Hatchet or you know, whatever they're called, I don't get an advance. So I work without an agent. But they publish it and they pay for everything. Now I get 40% of whatever the book, you know, whatever sales. But the only difference is I don't get an advance, and so I don't have an agent at the moment. Because agents hate this stuff.
Then if you got an agent, then the agent sort of has to kind of wait it out too, right?
Well, the agent is kind of cut out of the deal because if there is no advance, there's no money for an agent.
Well, that's right. The agent could if you eventually make something on it, the agent could take something out of that, I suppose.
Well, it depends on your contract.
Having worked with agents,
I've had three so far.
If you're going to get anything, you're going to get something.
Yeah, right. Well, that's part of it. What most agents do, and we should probably go back to talking about book. But what most agents do is that they'll sell you to a small press, hoping that maybe you will attract a readership. And then they'll be able to sell you on the basis of that to a larger, traditional publisher that actually pays out advances. Which was the story, interestingly enough, I found out, behind that whole 50 Shades of Grey thing. That puppy started out as a Twilight fanfic. And this gal wrote this thing as a Twilight fan fiction that she would pass around to all of her friends, and apparently it got enough of a readership that she actually had a publisher contact her and say, you know, this can't be a Twilight thing, but can you rewrite it so that it's not Twilight? That really, you know, there are novels that come out in certain genres that kind of take the whole entire genre in a different direction. This was one of them. You want mommy porn? This is mommy porn. I mean, this is a young woman shackled in a basement, and this is pure B&D. And apparently, this used to be porn, but now it's, you know, you find it on the shelf of Barnes & Noble. It's insane.
I know. Sometimes, you know, but Harry Potter started out as a self-published book, you know.
It was a small press in England. It wasn't so much. Well, It was, I think she, I don't know whether she actually paid to publish it. The poor woman didn't have a pot to piss in. I mean, she was a welfare mom with a couple of kids and stuff. So I don't know if she actually paid money to publish it, but it was a small British press, and I think it was might have been somebody.
Well, we're not selling Harry Potter. So she's doing Rollins is doing fine without our help. We're selling The Dear Departed. Tell us again, because where we can get it and buy it and because we're getting to the top of the hour here.
Okay,
it's
Amazon.com. You can buy it at Amazon. Just search for The Dear Departed or for Anne Roebuck, A-N-N-E Roebuck, R-O-E-B-U-C-K. And it's published by Burroughs Publishing Group. And it's available as either a Kindle ebook or a trade paperback. And we'll see if it goes in the modern romance market. It's the problem with Dion Fortune, of course, originally when it was written, is there was no sex, you know. And now you get the whole astral sex thing and the fact that
astral sex, which is fine as long as you don't make an astral of yourself.
Well, yeah. And
anyway,
that solves the birth control problem, I guess, right there.
Yeah.
Nobody gets pregnant in these books. But it was fun to write, and I'm hoping that I can get enough of a readership that because I think women are ready for these kinds of ideas, but they have to be presented as something other than you take vows of celibacy. You know, your talk last week about Jesus and Mary Magdalene and the Hieros Gamos, where she sort of lies back and thinks of England while he impregnates her. I thought, oh, come on, it may be fine for him, but for her, it's kind of a.
The thing with Jesus and Mary Magdalene, which I've been trying to get across is that the whole thing that's just the first century version of Baal and Astarte and Isis and Osiris.
Of course.
It comes right straight down from them, and Jesse Weston knew that, and Hippolytus knew it, and they all knew it, but nobody wanted to put it into words, hey, that's where it comes down. So, I don't see that much difference, really, when you get down to it between, Astarte and Jesus and Mary Magdalene.
But there's another part of it in that in order to defeat the evil magician, the magician, the initiate, the mage, has to have female help. And one of the things that I stress in the book is that the only way our hero defeats the evil thought form is because he has the help of the heron. She comes around and believes in him and in his magic, and she is the means by which he defeats the thought form. He can't do it without her. So you have this this muse idea, idea of the female being, you know, the goddess, the initiatrix who makes it possible for him to break through his blockages or whatever and reclaim his power and all that. So,
I remember Gerald Gardner, Gerald Gardner and the two Saxon boys that decide that they're going to recover their family estate and everything else, and so they summon up Barzabal. And one of them gets possessed by Barzabal, and they ask him, where do we, how do we attain the power of magic? And he says, seek the witch of Wanda.
So they go off and they find a witch, and then they actually get things going.
And that's High Magic's aid.
Yeah.
Of course.
Well, he was very much that was classic. Craft with Robert Graves. I mean, that was the whole Robert Graves thing, was that you had to have the female, the goddess, the genius, the muse in order to inspire you to do much of anything. So that's Dionne Fortune is full of this. I mean, she's all of her books are concerned with the goddess being the priestess being the one who sets the hero straight on what he needs to do. So that was an inspiration there, is the sea priestess and moon magic right there.
Yep, right.
So,
and
anyway.
those are great books.
Oh, they
okay,
are.
Okay, yeah. So next week fairy magic and everything we can think of that goes along with it, and so let's all pitch in and get the Dear Departed up so Anne and Horatio can get
if it does well, then the publisher will want more. And there
That's
you are.
Right.
The more you like magical books, the more magical books will be published.
I agree. Yeah. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity here. It's always a lot of fun.
Well, you're one of our favorite people, and we'll call in next week, and we'll hold forth on the fairies
Yeah,
the little fairies that they used to take photos of.
Not the cannibal fairies from my Sherlock Holmes. Remember, the cannibal fairies were flying up McGregor's kilt.
you've got those wonderful fairy photos that they used to take in Victorian times. You know, where they have this double exposure. You know, with this little doll with the little fairy wings.
Yeah, right. Okay. Good night, Anne, and everybody, and until next week, good magic.
Okay, bye.